Dein altes Sofa zerfällt langsam und die Black-Friday-Angebote sind wirklich unschlagbar. Aber dein Gehalt kommt erst Anfang des Monats. Kein Problem, mit der PayPal-Bezahlung nach 30 Tagen. So hast du jetzt mehr Spielraum beim Bezahlen und der Betrag wird nach 30 Tagen automatisch und kostenlos von deinem Konto oder deiner Karte abgebucht. Alle Infos auf paypal.de/30 Tage. PayPal es. Vorbehaltlich Kreditwürdigkeitsprüfung verfügbar mit deutschem PayPal-Konto für Einkäufe zwischen 1 und 2.000 Euro.
Stu does America.
Follow the show, if you would, on YouTube. That means going to youtube.com/StuDoesAmerica and clicking follow or subscribe or whatever the button says. Because I'm there all the time focusing on this, so I want you to know I know exactly what you're supposed to do. Also have the latest coming up on the rapidly evolving Epstein file situation. And that's a big story today. We're going to spend a decent amount of time on that in just a couple of minutes. We're also going to talk about the Department of Education. Are we finally going to be rid of it? There's some indications that we could be moving in the right direction on that. But we're going to start by doing the foundations of American life. This is sort of a big picture topic, right? We can talk about all the small stuff, and we'll get into some of the small minutiae of the Epstein stuff here in a couple of minutes. But I do think it's important to kind of look at where we are as a society and which way we're going right now. And why all that's happening. I think most people look at the country today and the world and just say, gosh, we are going in the wrong direction. There's a lot that's going wrong. And it doesn't feel like a lot is going right. And there's some reasons for that. You know, sure, we could talk about affordability and we can talk about all these political type issues. But I think it's deeper than that here in the country right now. And it starts with sort of the big foundations, the things that make America, America, the things that you when you think of forming a healthy, solid quality life, you think about these types of things, or at least we always have. And I want to start with a chart that has kind of gone viral here over the past month or two. And this has to do with the topic of marriage. Now, 12th grade girls are less likely than boys to say they want to get married someday. And this is the chart that kind of went viral here. It's now girls say that they are less likely than boys to get married. This is the percentage of 12th graders that say they are most likely to choose to get married in the long run. Now, boys, pretty consistent on this. I mean, boys get kind of beat around because, you know, they're the dogs and they're out there doing their thing. And, you know, they're not committal. How many romantic comedies started with that premise over the years? But if you look at it, they're kind of basically the same as they were in, you know, 30 years ago. From 1993 to 2023, boys went from 76% of 12th graders saying they wanted to get married someday. And it's dropped a little bit to 74%. The big difference has happened with girls. 83% said they wanted to get married, which was higher in 1993 than boys by 7 points. Now they have dropped below boys and are at 61% that want to get married. That's gone from 83 to 61, a 22-point drop, and they're now 13 points behind boys on that. Now, there's a bunch of issues that sprout out of a situation like that. Number one, you know, you get that, the exaggerated edge of this development is the incel situation, right? There's no longer seemingly a lot of girls that want to get with guys. And so there's fewer to choose from, fewer to go around, if you will. Now, we're not talking about Olivia Newsy. That was yesterday, the monologue. She gets around fine. But it does seem that there are fewer women who are looking to get married and get into these long-term relationships. And of course, we know, you know, what side of the aisle this is coming from. It's probably also the reason why you're seeing a growth in the trad wife, the sort of traditional culture fighting back against that development. We'll see if that trend turns around long-term. But that's a significant development. If you think back to the time in the 90s, this is when I'm in high school in the 90s, and I'm thinking to myself, well, the romantic comedies of that era, right, are all about how guys just don't want to commit, right? And at that point, there was only a 7-point difference between boys and girls in this statistic. Fast forward to now, and there's a 13-point difference the opposite way. I don't see any, there's not a lot of movies about how women don't want to commit. Of course, this is the culture they do. Hollywood does what they do. Now, this is a little more of a breakdown of this. This is the same statistic, but a little bit broken down here. 67% of people, 12th graders overall, say that they are going to get married someday. That's down from 80%. There is now, there started at 5% making the choice back in 1993, saying they don't want to get married. That's up to 9%, so almost doubling. saying they're never going to get married. The rest are undecided. No idea, they say. And about half, this is not just marriage, it's also children. Half of 12th graders say it's very likely they'll want kids if they marry. So do you want to stay married to the same person for life in 2023? That number's way down. Again, it was 59% in the 1993 poll, 51% in the 2023 poll. The overall number dropping from 84 to 80. Do you want to have children? That number has dropped as well, overall from 82 to 73. And a big drop from people who are very likely to do it from 64 to 48%. So fewer people in our society are looking at it as a marriage, as a goal in their lives. We know every metric, this is no exaggeration, every financial metric, every well-being metric, every happiness metric, all of these things are improved when you get married. That is a foundational part of our society and has been true for decades and decades and decades and decades. If you get married, and of course, like, well, I got married and then my husband sucked. Yeah, some of them are awful. There's no doubt about it. Some husbands are awful. Some wives are awful. Some marriages break up. There's a lot of that going on. That's absolutely true. However, the more crucial part of this particular situation is when you do get married, generally speaking, your life turns out better, right? Like it's just you get better outcomes across the board in basically every way that we can measure it. So the fact that girls are now saying, I don't know if I want to get married, is seemingly an echo of this cultural approach of particularly left-leaning women who are saying, I don't need a man. I don't need that. I'm independent. I'm going to do these things on my own. And look, there's a good part of that. Like, I want my daughter to think as an independent person. I don't want her to think as a person who is, subservient to some guy that she just met. But forming a family and coming up with ways to deal with situations and coming up with ways to handle the tough times in life, it's not only just a financial benefit, it's just a sanity benefit. It's hard to do these things on your own. Life is hard when you're on your own and you're just sitting with your cat all day. Okay, that's hard. Marriage can be difficult as well, of course, but it is also something that helps you solve a lot of these problems, even though sometimes it doesn't feel like it. It's one of those things that American society has had baked into it for a very long time, and getting rid of that is a bad thing. It's not going to turn out well. Same thing with kids. Again, this is something that you look to as an idea that, this is the perfect life, right? The American dream. You have the house, you have the kid, you have the kids, you have the wife, have the husband, and you go through life with that nice picket fence and hopefully grow as a family, experience things together, and you build those bonds. People are turning away from that. And it's not a crisis situation yet, I would argue. I don't think it's, dropped those levels, but the trends are bad. Really, really bad. And if it continues, it will turn into a crisis. This is a fascinating part of this as well. This is from Focus on the Family, Marriage, Health in America, a series of polls that they did. And what they found was that people who are able to combine their marriage and family with faith also do much better. This is percentage of marriages that are healthy. Only 70% of non-Christians are saying that they're healthy. When you come to convictional Christians, born-again Christians, much, much higher than that, 79 and 82%. So what does that mean? I mean, because that's a good thing, right? You say, okay, this is something that you can achieve, right? Getting married, a lot of people just say, go out and get married and have lots of kids. I mean, that's great general advice. It is a thing that is helpful to you. Not always easy, though, right? Like, I mean, there was plenty of times in my life I was like, who's going to deal with me for multiple decades? And honestly, like, the people that have chosen to do that, particularly my wife, it is a questionable decision. Like, I don't know. It doesn't seem like I wouldn't have made the same decision if I were looking at me. But she did, thankfully. It's not always something that we can solve, right? You don't always find the person that you want to be with for the rest of your life when you want to. This is not, it's not like, plug and play. And a lot of times, I think, particularly on the conservative side right now, we're sort of treating it as this plug-and-play thing. You should get married early. Well, great advice if the right situation pops up, if you're pursuing it in a smart way, in a way that, a lot of times is led by faith, you probably come out with good outcomes on that. Get married early if you find the right person, sure, but find the right person. That's something important, and go about it the right way. Now, when you combine that with faith, that's great, and we see much better results when you have marriage and kids and faith all working together. Problem with that equation is, of course, faith is fading in this country. And there's been some people who've been posting things. We've talked about some of them that have these really optimistic takes about where we are with faith. I don't think it's I don't think it's accurate. I think we are in a more serious situation than that. The drop in the U.S. religiosity is among the largest in the world. This is a Gallup poll. And here's a bunch of countries. You know, you see the drop from you know, going back. This is only a 10-year decline. The United States went from 66% of people saying religion is an important part of their daily lives, 66%, down to 49%. That puts us behind, you know, Chile and Turkey and Portugal, and basically equal with Greece and Italy. Now, again, like Italy and Greece, you'd think were countries that we used to say, oh, we're more religious than Europe, and Italy would be the type of country you might use as an example. Of that. Well, we are not in the right position as far as that goes. And you see a drop over a long period of time from, you know, the past 20 years or so, from almost 70% of people saying it's an important part of daily life down to less than half, a minority of the American people for the first time. You see the top line on this particular chart. I'll explain this for the podcast peeps as well. But, you know, that number globally is been around 80% the entire time. We've dropped from 70 to about 50. And when you took it, the OECD, which is, you know, economically developed countries, has been around 40, now dropped to 36%. So we're falling toward the people who don't have faith around the world, those countries. We're trending toward Europe, right? We're trending towards that rather to the classic American view, which is a higher percentage and a higher favorability for religion. Now, this isn't all bad news. There's some groups that are turning this around a little bit. One racial group in the U.S. is more religious than the others. Which one is it? Well, Black Americans ranked more devout in each category than white Americans and Hispanic Americans, according to this poll. This is the group had higher rankings in each category than Americans overall. According to the poll, 62% of Black Americans said they personally pray one or more times per week. It's the only racial group to have a majority that said this. I mean, we talk about, you know, there's all this talk that comes out about, you know, are we a Christian nation, right? And, you know, David Barton's done great work along with Glenn and the Mercury Museum to kind of show all the deep faith that was in the lives of our founders and in the founding documents. That's all real. There was a real Christian basis to this country. And there's this other world where we're talking about Christian nationalism, which is, you know, kind of a totally different thing that, you know, not something that I'm, you know, interested in as a country. I don't think that's a good development. And I think there's some really scary things on that front. And the other side of this, though, you know, the fact that only one racial group prays once a week is an indication that we are not acting like a Christian nation. Whether you think we are or not, whether you're thinking of the basis or these new developments, whatever you're thinking of, it doesn't seem like we're hitting those marks all that often. Americans overall, 14 points higher for Blacks than Americans overall for praying. 47% of white Americans, 48% of Hispanic Americans say they pray weekly or more. 39% of Black Americans said they read the Bible or another sacred text weekly or more, about 15% higher than how white and Hispanics responded, which was 23 and 24%. And then when it came down to how often each group attended religious services, Black Americans again ranked higher. 32% said they attended weekly or more. 24% of whites and Hispanics, or 22% of Hispanics said they went to religious services once a week or more. So the picture here I'm painting is a picture of a country that is saying, we'd like to get married less. We'd like to have children less. We'd like to go to church less. Those things working together are not going to give you positive outcomes. And then you add on to this what has developed, and I think for good reason, a deep skepticism of our government institutions. On top of that, trust in government depends on party control, which is true, but either way, it's way, way, way down. Can your federal government handle international problems? Down from 75 to 45. Can they handle domestic problems? Down from 70 to 35. The executive branch, you have trust in that, down from 75 to 35. Judicial branch, you have trust in that, down from probably 80. in the early 2000s down to about 50 now. Legislative branch down from 75 to 30. All these, with the exception of the judicial branch I mentioned, from 1972 to 2025. So a 50-year strain here, or 50-year run. That is a big drop in all those things. Now, you might say, and might be thinking, well, wait a minute, Stu, isn't it a good thing that we don't have faith in government institutions like that? I think there is a healthy element of that, honestly. When you say, hey, can the federal government solve all your problems domestically or in foreign affairs? And you say no, that's what I would say. That's not a change for me over the years. That's how I think I felt at least most of my entire life. I don't think that they can do that. Maybe some, I would say I have more doubts on how they handle foreign affairs. I never had any confidence in them at all and when it comes to domestic affairs. The point being, though, it is healthy, I think, for a country to have skepticism and not have blind trust on our government. And that's the way this poll is worded. But it's also just our institutions generally. Like, we just don't even think they're trying to do the best things for us. And that, of course, comes from decades and a lifetime of evidence, right, where it does not seem like they are doing that. Now, part of this also is party. And this is the part that I think reduces the value of this type of look at this particular foundation of government and human life in America. Because basically, you know, we just switch when it comes to party. Like, for example, Republicans, can we handle international problems? From 2024 to 2025, that went from 20% of people trusting the government to 84%. Well, what happened there? Donald Trump got elected. Because you see that in the other thing with Democrats, it was 74% of people in 2024. Now it's down to 17%. The executive branch in particular went from 9% in 2024 for Republicans, 9% trust, to 92% trust. So 9 to 92, kind of a big jump. The opposite happened with Democrats, went from 82 to 4. And basically, the people in the middle roughly stayed the same. It is a very partisan situation, but overall, those numbers have been trending down, even though the partisan sides keep switching each and every election. Young Americans are seeing this as well. They're continuing to lose faith in government institutions. Only 19% of respondents expressed trust in the federal government to do the right thing most or all of the time. Congress won the lowest vote of confidence from the young respondents. Only 18% said they trusted the legislative body. The office of the president wasn't far behind, only 23%. 29% said they trusted the Supreme Court. I think, you know, especially because it's not, you know, the Supreme Court has all sorts of rulings that I don't like, even today, where it's actually pretty good. I mean, the court right now is in a pretty good position for conservatives. They're generally speaking on the right side of things, not always, but generally speaking. But still, you'd think that they have a higher approval rating than either the Congress or the presidency. And a large part of that is because these people are always running for election in our face and reminding us constantly who they are. We don't like them very much. Democrats in particular are facing a significant reckoning from young Americans. Support for the party is declining sharply. This is part of that Democrat civil war we've been spending a lot of time on lately. Approval of congressional Democrats from 42% dropping to 23% in the last decade, basically. By contrast, approval of congressional Republicans has basically held steady, 29% to 28%. So Republicans are staying equally bad. Like, they didn't... They weren't happy with we thought they sucked before, and we still think they suck. Democrats had a little bit more faith in the government. That has really kind of degraded over the years. And again, for good reason, right? They've done a terrible job. All of this adds up to kind of the American dream, right? What do you think of when you think of the American dream? You think of hopefully a country that has a government that runs somewhat sanely, but mainly you're thinking of marriage, you're thinking of kids, you're thinking of church, you're thinking of that and home ownership, right? Those are the things that everyone puts together. I do want to push back on one viral poll, and maybe we'll do more on this tomorrow, but this is a poll that has gone very, very viral. And I will say most people, including Glenn brought this up on the air on radio the other day. Most people kind of see this as a real problem, a real crisis that has developed over a long period of time. We're going the wrong way on this. And this is the median age of U.S. home buyers. You may have seen this chart online. What it shows is, now this is first-time buyers. It shows repeat buyers as well. Which, you know, again, you'd think would be higher. So first-time buyers, the big problem, the thing mostly focused on this poll is first-time buyers. And you see it raised from 29 years old back in the 80s. That has risen now to 40. And people are saying this is a major, major crisis. I want to spend more time on this tomorrow. Maybe we'll do, though, I could honestly do the entire monologue on this chart and home ownership generally, because I don't think that home ownership is a great a great measure of what the American dream should be. You know, home ownership can be great for some people. It's also a very complicated thing. It's not a universal good, where I would argue largely marriage, if it works out, is kind of a universal good. Having kids, you know, again, there are bad marriages. There are things that break apart. Kids wind up, you know, you might have a nightmare kid, whatever. You know, sometimes it doesn't work out. But generally speaking, a good. Homeownership, not always a good. It's not always the right thing to lock a young person into a 30-year mortgage when they're 25 years old. That might not be the best thing for them. So I think there's a bigger discussion around that. But on this chart in particular, I want to draw your attention to one thing, and we'll maybe readdress this a little bit more in depth tomorrow. But I wonder here, what we're looking at in this rise of age in first-time home buyers, is that a long-term economic crisis? That's option A, kind of what everyone's saying. Or is this just an artifact of the COVID era? Look at that chart again. And I added a green line here to kind of highlight what I'm talking about. And if you see the green line, what you see is literally zero increase from the time that I was in high school all the way till COVID. All the increase we're talking about, all of it, 100% of this increase has occurred since COVID, and it's gone from 32 in 1993-94 to 32 for the average homeowner first time in 2019. Ever since then, it's shot almost directly up. And if you think about this from a real world perspective, you had a couple of different things working together here. You had a situation where, first of all, there's a lot of economic craziness that went on around COVID that put all sorts of craziness into our world, right? Giant checks coming from the government, people losing their jobs at record rates, all that stuff plays into it. But in addition to that, you saw massively low interest rates leading into that period, people buying and buying and buying and locking in low, low interest rates. And I know from personal experience, you know, I have zero interest from leaving my home. Why? I've got a 3% mortgage. And I will live, if every house on my street turned into a crack house tomorrow, I would say to my wife, I don't know, 3%? I think we stay. Have you ever sold crack? Should we get into the business? What's the situation? The people who had houses or in houses are doing everything they can to stay in them. So that's reducing the amount of turnover in these homes for people to kind of come in and buy new homes. And then secondarily, rates skyrocketed after that, meaning people trying to get into home ownership are looking at it and saying, well, wait a minute, that's all I get for this money? I have to give 6-7% in interest and I'm paying all of this in interest? That's a fortune. And I'm getting less than I picture I would for the price because all the rates went through the roof. And of course, prices have continued to increase. All that stuff working together, I think, is an artifact of the COVID era, and I don't know how long that lasts. That might be a crisis, right? Like, it might be something that something has to be done eventually on. But I don't think the evidence points to the fact that this is a long-term developing crisis that is this massive change in our economy. I think what it was a one-time crazy event that we're still feeling the echoes from in so many different ways. I mean, even some of those other polls, when it comes to faith and it comes to marriage and it comes to social time with others, you know, marriage rates are going to drop if you don't spend any time with other people. COVID continued a long-term trend and emphasized the long-term trend of people not socializing with each other. And that's only become worse. Of course, you know, there's, you know, cell phones and all these other things that play into that as well. But like COVID, we want to look back at it as this horrible thing that happened in the past that we should just forget. And then maybe the only time we ever pay attention to it is when we're like asking for a prosecution of a particular official who had wrongdoing. That is part of looking back at COVID. But we have to also recognize that a lot of the stuff that we're looking at today are artifacts of that era. And, you know, it might be a situation where we have a new normal, or it might be a situation where this stuff bounces back to more normal times over a long period of time. But home ownership is not the type of thing that turns around in a couple of weeks or a couple of years. It is these things are long-term trends. And I do fear that this number is going to be higher for a while, though I don't know that it's infinite. Maybe we'll get into that a little bit more tomorrow. But I think when you think about all this stuff and you wonder about how the country is looking today, you're looking about, you know, what the future looks like. These are foundational things we need to figure out how to address. Because if people want to get married less, they want to have children less, they want to go to church less, They are owning their homes at a lower rate. That gives you a very complicated picture as to what our future looks like. And, as you know, most of it points towards, I think, really bad things. You know, add into a lot of unknowns like AI and that revolution that's coming. How are we going to handle that thing? It's like, well, you have to think that someone who has foundational values, who has foundational principles, who believes in things, who has a rock solid base for their family, those types of people are far more likely to be able to deal with a potential AI revolution than those who are just kind of blowing in the wind with no real belief system. How are they going to handle it? We have a lot of big questions coming up around the corner. Now, we have a second really big story today that is going on. This is the Epstein Files saga. We have got a bunch of updates on that. We'll go through that next. You know, if you want better days, you got to start with your nights. And this is amazing how many problems, stress and fogginess, like kind of mental fog, low energy, irritability. This can be traced back to the fact that you've been running on bad sleep for longer than you realize. And fixing that doesn't, require a complicated overhaul a lot of times. It's just something that can take one habit and make it really work. Beams Dream Powder is one of those rare products that actually lives up to its promise. It's a natural nighttime blend you mix into warm milk or water. And within a little while, honestly, you start feeling your body kind of easing out of the tension of the day. You fall asleep faster, you stay asleep longer, and you wake up without that sort of blah feeling that so many sleep aids leave behind. My daughter loves this stuff. In fact, she was having some real trouble sleeping. This is probably, 6 months or a year ago. And we had some Beam powder. I was like, why don't you give this a shot? It's like a delicious hot chocolate. Like there's a bunch of great flavors. There's a cinnamon one. There's like a caramel one. I think there's a fudge brownie version of it. Really good stuff. You're going to like the taste of it. But she started taking it and before she went to bed, and it really helped her calm down and like let the day go away and just, fall asleep. She really likes it. I really like it as well. Shopbeam.com/stew is the place to go to get this. Use code stew. You get 50% off Beam's cyber sale. You can grab the Dream Powder for just $32.50. This is there's a bit of a catch to this because it's only available until it sells out. So they're only running this for a limited time, but think about how much you would pay for a truly great night of sleep. With Beam's cyber price, it's just $1.08 per night. Well worth it. Go to shopbeam.com/stew, shopbeam.com/stew. Try Beam today.
Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
All right, it's Epstein time. Are you ready for another edition of it? Let me get you up to speed. Of course, Congress did pass. Yesterday we talked about the House passing the bill. Congress acts swiftly to force release of Epstein files, and Trump agrees to sign the bill. So the Senate voted unanimously for this. The House vote was 427-1. A couple points on this. Number one, none of this was necessary. It's important to note that, Donald Trump doesn't need a bill to release all this. He could have just released it before. Obviously, he was against releasing it for various reasons. Depends on who you are, I suppose, as to what you think those reasons are. But generally speaking, he could have just done it. Now, he also doesn't necessarily have to pay attention to this exactly. There is some wiggle room for him around the edges. But generally speaking, this should force the release of the Epstein files. There was it was interesting because there was a lot of talk about it having a long road in the Senate, back when the House bill passed. And I don't know. I was like, I think this is going to come out. I think once you get a 427-1 vote, usually this stuff is going to actually wind up happening. That is what wound up occurring. Higgins was the one guy, we mentioned him yesterday, who voted no. He said he was he took a principled stand on this. And his opposition to this, it would be interesting to talk to him about this. I'm fascinated by people who do this. I like the people who vote as the one vote in Congress when it's like 434-1, right? I like hearing the stories of the one person. Now, There's a bunch of reasons this could happen. People had pointed out that a previous, I won't get into the details, a previous congressman was a one vote against one of these bills, and then later came out there was accusations against that one person. I don't necessarily think that's what's happening here. It is a situation where he was basically like, I'm worried about names coming out. And they say victims, and victims is a weird term here, because the victims largely, generally speaking, are cheering these things being released. Okay. You know, they will redact the name of these victims, you know, so you don't hear maybe some of the salacious details about the terrible things that happened to them. But like, you know, generally speaking, the victims are cheering this on. They want them out. People in the Congress that were opposing this, Trump and a bunch of Republicans who were quite clearly only voting against this because they were, you know, Trump wanted them to. One of them even said it. I can't remember who it was. But they're like, well, you wait a minute. You said you were a principled no before. What's changed now? Well, Trump told me to vote for it. OK, I don't think that's how our government's supposed to work, to be quite honest with you. But OK, at least they're being honest about it. You know, the situation here with this is, you know, the victims here, if you will, are not really the victims of Epstein. The victims of Epstein are already victims of much, much worse than can happen with a document release, number one. And number two, they basically want the documents out. They're cheering this on largely. The actual victims, I think, to be worried about in this situation are people who had some either interaction that was benign with Jeffrey Epstein. And there were a lot of people. Particularly the earlier days, this email account that they just released was 2011, which was all the emails that came out were after Epstein was dealing with the legal problems. But, you know, like a lot of the people, like Donald Trump is a good example of this. Trump had no relationship with Epstein until after this, he had no relationship with him after the allegations were known. That's a big deal, right? Like, there's going to be a lot of people who are going to have a quote unquote association with Jeffrey Epstein in these files that are going to be victims of people running their name through the mud on the internet and through the media who had not even an accusation of actual illegal activity, let alone doing it themselves. So I think that's where the worry is. And I think that's what Trump was probably trying to protect here. He probably has people who are friends and donors who had relationships with Jeffrey Epstein. You know, I don't know how late. And to me, there's a line there. There's a real big line. Like if you had a relationship with him before the allegations were known, to me, you're basically in the clear. Now, you might think the guy was a bad guy anyway, but I can't get all that worried about it, honestly. Then there's a period of after the allegations and before, let's say, 2018, that chunk, where it's, to me, an absolute no-go, right? Like, I'm not going to Jeffrey Epstein for a relationship for any reason after he's been, you know, charged and, you know, admits to hooking up with a 14-year-old girl. But, you know, it wasn't widely known. It wasn't like, you know, it was known. I'm not saying, again, I just think, I don't think there's a big excuse here, but I think there's a little bit less of an excuse if it's before 2018. 2018, the Miami Herald reporting comes out that lays all this stuff out in real detail. I remember hearing the allegations of the island and what's going on before 2018, but not knowing the extent of it until 2018. If you're getting in touch with him in 2019, you're freaking insane. Like, you should know this guy's a terrible guy at that point. Now, I bring that up, and there's a lot of people you will know. I mean, you know, we know, for example, you know, Steve Bannon was doing, interviews with Jeffrey Epstein in 2019. And so, like, I'm sure that's going to be part of these releases. People that Trump knows, maybe donors of his, maybe friends of his, business associates, are probably going to be in these files at some point. That does not mean they had sex with anybody. That does not mean that they, hooked up with 14-year-olds. But, like, there's questionable parts about them that could be revealed. And that brings me to Larry Summers. Larry Summers resigns now from the board of OpenAI in the wake of these Epstein email revelations. Now, if you don't remember Larry Summers, he was the Treasury Secretary under President Obama. And he has a sort of, he's one of those guys you might actually say, this is a very rare term, but that I will almost never use, but because there's not many of these people. But you put him in the category maybe of center left, right? He is definitely on the left. He's definitely a Democrat. But he will occasionally speak up against his own party. He was one of the main people who came out and said, hey, just so you guys are aware, all the spending from Biden after COVID is going to cause inflation. This is going to be a massive problem. Nobody listened to him on the left. They abandoned him. They hated him for that. He's also, you know, tried to make points about academic achievement between men and women. He's been run through the mud for that stuff. And that might be more consistent with what, a conservative might look at these stats and say, you're overblowing the controversy here. Anyway, he is in the Epstein files and these emails that came out. That's different than what's going to come out from the DOJ. So there's going to be even more stuff. But in those emails that came out from the estate of Jeffrey Epstein, Larry Summers is in there going, and this is unbelievable, going to Jeffrey Epstein and saying, hey, can you be my wingman here? Can you help me figure out how I can hook up with this girl I want to hook up with? Now, again, he's a guy in his, 60s, 70s at this point. I don't even know. He's older. And he's talking about one of his students, seemingly, or one of his mentees, he calls her, a Chinese economist that I guess he was studying under, hopefully not literally under, Larry Summers. And he was trying to basically figure out how to hook up with her and was asking for advice from Jeffrey Epstein, a guy who's known to go after underage girls. Weird thing to do. Creepy thing to do. I'm glad we know that about Larry Summers, and I certainly would not want him teaching my kid at Harvard. That being said, that is also not the focus of what this investigation is about. We're talking about trying to get people who committed illegal acts. When you take yourself out of the Epstein situation and just think of this from a privacy, I've talked a lot today, a privacy standpoint. Like, is there, like, should we be just going out and releasing all these files of people who are not even accused of crimes? Like, should we know that Larry Summers had an affair or was trying to have an affair? His wife, I'm sure, wants to know. We know more about Larry Summers. I guess that's good. But, like, should the government be doing these things? Like, should the government be like, hey, we're going to out this affair and we're going to tell you about it's blown up his public life. Judging by his behavior, his public life should have been blown up, but that's different than a legal argument. You know, what is the legal argument for the U.S. government to be releasing stuff about some guy's affair? I don't know that there is one. So, I can see the hesitation. Oh, my God, I didn't even get to the Jasmine Crockett stuff, which is the best stuff here. I got to take a break. Let me take a break. We'll come back on the other side with maybe a little Jasmine Crockett, Jeffrey Epstein stuff, which is utterly fantastic, and other news of the day. We'll do that next.
Persil sorgt schon seit 1907 für tiefenreine Wäsche, auch bei den Johnsons. Oder, Anna?
Das stimmt. Sogar meine Oma hat schon mit Persil gewaschen.
Und als Dankeschön für über 100 Jahre Vertrauen gibt's jetzt bis zu 15 Euro Rabatt auf unser Bestes.
Das mit der roten Schleife.
Genau, made in Germany. Mehr Infos auf unserbestes.persil.de.
Wenn es tiefenrein ist, ist es Persil.
Okay, so the Trump administration is launching a plan to dismantle the Department of Education. This is something, of course, that has been promised my entire life from conservatives, going back to, like, Reagan. Like, that's how long every president's always said, oh, I'm going to get rid of the Department of Education. Never really happens. And I will be honest with you, I'm not, like, entirely sure it's going to happen this time either, but the Trump administration is implementing a widely telegraphed plan to shutter Education Department by transferring critical responsibilities to other federal agencies. We talk about this a lot when it comes to these big agencies. We want to get rid of the FBI. Well, I mean, the FBI does a lot of things. Yeah, they do some things that are annoying. They also do a lot of things we really need, right? So we can get rid of the FBI if you want, but you have to be able to take the things that are important and move them to other areas because you can't just, delete every investigation the FBI is doing. Same thing with the Department of Education. There's all sorts of, we don't need to get into all of it right now, but there are functions of the Department of Education that, you're probably going to want, even in a world where the Department of Education does not exist. So we're moving in the right direction on that. I know Linda McMahon is pretty focused on it, so it'll be great to see if this actually happens, cheering on the administration on that one. Also, we do have Jasmine Crockett, as promised, with, you know me. I freaking love Jasmine Crockett. I love her. I want her to be around forever. I want her to run in every race forever. She is awesome and perfect and should never change. Jasmine Crockett's attempt to burn Lee Zeldin over Epstein blows up in her face. Now, this happens all the time when Jasmine Crockett tries to do things. When she tries to do things, they typically blow up in her face because she's incredibly stupid. That is something that the main reason I love her so. And again, she should be. We talked, Charlemagne the God pointed it out. She should be the face of the Democratic Party. They should lean into her. Yes, yes, and yes. That's exactly what they should do. Here's yet another piece of evidence supporting that idea.
Folks who also took money from somebody named Jeffrey Epstein, as I had my team dig in very quickly, Mitt Romney, the NRCC, Lee Zeldin, George Bush, Win Red, McCain Palin, Rick Lazio. I just want to be clear. If this is the standard that we're going to make, just know we're going to expose it all. And just know that the FEC filings, they are available for everybody to review. This is absolutely ridiculous.
It is absolutely ridiculous. Yes. I mean, let me just give you the reveal here. Yes, there, Jeffrey Epstein did donate to all of these groups that she talked about and all these candidates that she talked about. Of course, the truth is, it was a different Jeffrey Epstein. Oof, Jasmine for U.S. is disastrously wrong here. None of these donors are the Jeffrey Epstein. Several are from the same Dr. Jeffrey Epstein, and the donations to Lee Zeldin are from after Epstein killed himself. Here's the list of donations. You can look at them right here. And again, we're talking about, you know, a couple hundred dollars here and there. None of this came from actual Jeffrey Epstein, the one you might be worried about. Lee Zeldin did respond. He said, yeah, Crockett, a physician named Dr. Jeffrey Epstein, who is a totally different person than the other Jeffrey Epstein, donated to a prior campaign of mine. No freaking relation, you genius. What I want to focus on, though, I mean, first of all, the reason I love Jasmine Crockett so much is because she exists exactly in the intersection of stupidity and certainty. And that's why I love her so. She's such a moron, but so sure of herself in her stupidity. She knows nothing about anything, and yet she's so positive and insulting about how much smarter she is than you are, which I love. It just is nonstop entertainment. But the fact that she says a couple of interesting things in that clip, she put her team to dig into it. That's what they did. They just searched Jeffrey Epstein and printed out the page and handed it to you. You should fire everyone on your team after something like that. That is like an absolutely inexcusable mistake. Secondarily, she also says something that's revealing where she says someone named Jeffrey Epstein. It's almost like she kind of knew that she was lying about these people, which also would just be not only stupidity and certainty, but also just, you know, hackery. She's awful in every single way. So I love her. We do have a merch on the site, Jasmine Crockett 28. If you want to root for her to be the Democratic nominee and nothing else, that's up on stewdoesmerch.com. Code is stew10 if you want to save 10%. But there you go. My Jasmine Crockett update for the day. So most of us assume the healthcare system will be there when we need it, right? The pharmacy has our prescriptions ready when it gets called in, and we get annoyed if this stuff doesn't happen. But real life doesn't always operate on that schedule. Storms hit and supply chains break and, you know, travel gets complicated. And suddenly you're in a situation where the medication you rely on isn't available to you when you need it. That's why Jace Medical exists. They created the Jace case just for this purpose. It's a supply of emergency antibiotics and essential medications prescribed by a licensed medical professional and delivered right to your home. So you're not left scrambling at the worst possible moment. You're not replacing your doctor. You're just giving yourself a safety net for the situations where the system doesn't work all that well. What I appreciate about it is how simple it is. You just fill out a quick consultation, your case ships, and it stays in your home as a backup in case you need it. When you need it, it's there. Jace.com. Use the promo code STEW at checkout for a discount on your order. It's Jace.com, Jase.com. The code is STEW. Okay, so here's what happened. Would you sue the government for access to a salty, sticky, brown byproduct? What if I could elevate that a little bit and say, what about a polarizing yeast-based spread? As delicious as that sounds, what I'm talking about here is Vegemite. Have you ever had this? We had it once here. We did it. I think it was on Pat and Stu. We did a taste test. It's one of the worst things I've ever tasted in my entire life. I don't understand how anybody could eat it. But an Australian prisoner is suing because he believes he has a human right to eat this trash. It's just awful. But he wants it, apparently. It's banned in prisons because it interferes with narcotic detection dogs. They basically smell this and they don't smell the drugs. Also, it could be produced, potential to be used in the production of alcohol, which isn't, I don't think, true. But anyway, sue for something else.